All right, well, welcome back to the Glue Guys. This is Mike here. Say hello, Brian.
Hello.
Check us out on Twitter at BK Glue Guys. iTunes, 5 stars. Rate them. We need them. We need the ratings. That's what we say, Brian, right?
I'm just stunned that my pipes came through this early in the AM. I haven't warmed up or anything.
I think it's going to be, I mean, it's going to be that Morning Joe vibe. Just a couple of guys cutting it up over talking about the Nets. The season that was and the season that will be, Brian.
Wow. Wow. Well, when you say it like that, Mike.
Welcome in. Sorry, I'm just pulling up multiple things. I apologize. This is The Glue Guys. Thank you all for joining us. We appreciate it, and we'd love to have you here. Brian.
Mike, what's up, Doug?
I got to say, so I'm sitting in my apartment, as I like to do at night. I like to sit in my apartment, and I was watching the NBA draft lottery happen, and One, there's an excitement because this is the last year, obviously, that the Nets will have to go through this torture of not being there, that their pick is represented by another team that owns their future. So there was excitement there, but there's also like real dread that this Cavs pick, which was the Nets pick, was going to be in the top three. Like there was a real sense of like, we're getting gut punched already, right? We're getting knocked with the Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum stuff. This would just be the other thing just to knock us right in the gut to like just to push us out for 20 years and we can never enjoy basketball after that point. I don't know. What was your consumption like with the NBA draft lottery, if at all?
I didn't watch it. I just like glanced at Twitter to make sure everything was okay and right in the world. And that's all I did. I peeked in and I was like, you know, phew, and that was it. Didn't think about it again. You know, you don't want to spend too much time worrying about that stuff, but you do want to make sure that, like, the Shannon Freuden happened, you know?
Well, it's like, I think in the, so I know we all remember, like, there used to be a time when the NBA draft lottery, it feels like so long ago, it was probably like 3 years ago, when they would do it in the halftime of a game. And I think it was like one of the Western or Eastern Conference Finals games, and they would do it at halftime. They do it quick. It would be 8 minutes. You would see all the representatives. Now it's an hour-long show where they have 18 people from ESPN talking about it. They have each team send someone who, you know, like the Hawks send someone who's, I guess, a part owner of the team, but who's also an actress who had been in, like, B-level movies, but she was totally charming. It's too much now. It's just too much. There's just not, I don't enjoy, I want the quick, just boom, boom, boom. I want to watch it, all right? I need to participate in it. I need to see it happen. There's an excitement in it, but I just can't. The whole event is now too big. It's no more fun, but it's also probably not fun because the Nets don't have their pick. Brian.
Mike.
Dude, we got a great show today, I think.
Have you been watching the playoffs, the playoff basketball that's been going on?
I have. It's well, give me your impressions of what you've been seeing.
Well, like we were just talking about, like I'm thinking like take Celtics to win it all. It's just like what's going on is so impossible. It's so magical. They're going Super Saiyan, like, oh my Lord, I'm on a group text right now.
If you can hear the buzzing and twirling.
And all they're doing is talking about how fun last night was, which is just, God, the most.
Who's in this group text?
My knucklehead friends.
That is so sweet.
I'm trying to turn it down, but I have a new phone and I don't know how anything works. It's a perfect storm. So anyways, yeah. So I don't know, like why go against the flow, this like magical team. I don't know. I don't really expect them to win at all, but like, what's happening here, Mike?
Well, so I do want to dispel the notion. So it is amazing that the Celtics are doing.
Marco Rubio over here dispelling notions.
Let's dispel the notion. I will say that there is talent on the team. Okay, so if you just want to, I understand Kyrie and Hayward. That's what $50 million on the bench or whatever injured. Fine. But there is, so Horford was, what, a top five pick? Marcus Smart, I think, also a top five pick. Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, top five picks. It's like, so we view this team because they are scrappy. Terry Rozier is adorable, and he's a scrappy young guy who's really like seizing on this new stardom that he has right now. Jason Tatum's amazing, and Jaylen Brown's great, and Al Horford's like the thinking man's favorite player, of course. But all these guys are super high draft picks. It's not as if this team is like all second round pick. It's actually not like before when it was Jay Crowder and Avery Bradley, like those were later in the first round, second round, undrafted guys that the Celtics and Brad Stevens was doing well with. This team is filled with high lottery players. They just happen to not have Kyrie and Gordon Hayward, but they have a ton of guys who many teams in the league would have viewed as super talented. It's surprising. I'm not saying it's not surprising. I'm just saying, like, I don't want to say that this team is all Brad Stevens and all his guile. It's not a guileful team of no talent hacks. It's a talented, it's not quite Friends level, but it is, you know, New Girl level talent on the sitcom scale, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting because it's like, I mean, this is an argument that we probably like tried to draw for the Nets at one point, but like they actually are good. So it's like the good version of it. But it's like when you have a team that doesn't need to defer to any like primary ball handler or scorer, like there's really no reason to not pass up for the better shot for any of these players. Like there's no one that you should like prioritize really over anyone else. And that kind of egalitarian play seems to foster some kind of like, I mean, this is it operating at the highest level it possibly can. For like, you know, people that you don't like when you're the Cavs or whoever who's designing a defensive strategy against this team, like you can say, okay, like key in on Al Horford, but that's not really that useful of a strategy. And there's no one like you really want to like chase down, like everyone's sort of people you want to chase down.
Well, and it would be interesting is if they played the Rockets in the finals, because the Rockets are the opposite. It's all ISOs. And like there's showed some, like James Harden ended 800 possessions in isolation plays on himself, and LeBron was number two at like 550. The gap between the Rockets and everyone else in the league in terms of isolations and single man ball is like incredible. So then if you had the Celtics play the Rockets, you would have the ultimate sort of like everyone gets to eat on the Celtics, and then the Rockets, it's like James Harden gets to eat, and then there'll be some scraps for everyone else if he's like kind of full. That's basically it. But
dude, that Rockets team is about to get whooped on, I feel like. I watched part of that game and I was like, actually this team suddenly seems kind of ragtag. It's like two guys and like a bunch of dudes I kind of don't want that much.
Well, and then like the fact, so obviously what, Durant had 45 points or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's like we kind of do forget that he is on the Warriors. And, you know, we can account for, I remember Zach Lowe has written some like incredible stuff leading up to these two, you know, the Eastern and Western Conference Finals, where he's really looked at the matchups. And it's almost like, well, if the Rockets do this, this, and this, then the Warriors are really going to have to react, and they're going to have to change their lineup. But, like, none of us really talk about, like, oh, yeah, they have a 7-footer who can dribble the ball and do everything that he wants to do offensively and then still play defense and still protect the rim if he really wanted to. You know, this series is going to go longer than four games. I actually don't know if the Celtics-Cavs is going to go longer than, like, I would bet five games, right? Like, obviously two games are down. You'd expect the Cleveland Cavaliers to win one game at home. But it's like, LeBron is incredible, but the rest of this Cavs team is trash. And for the most part is trash. I mean, we can all obsess over the Korver-Kevin Love two-man game that they do, but, you know, like that's not as effective as like we all think it to be, but
hot takes, Brian. Shall we jump into it?
Yes. So we are continuing our series of the Troika player reviews. Basically what we're doing is we're running through three players per pod for the next few pods. We did D'Angelo, Joe Harris, and Quincy Acey last pod. Now we're going to do Alan Crabb, Jared Allen, and Timofey Mozgov. So stay around for Timofey Mozgov, everyone. Brian, give me your general. So we're going to start with Alan Crabb. Obviously, you know, sort of like the headline of his season was, hey, that was disappointing. not as good as we thought he was going to be. What's your general, like, Alan Crabb takes to begin this pod?
So in classic Nets player form, Alan Crabb gave us a good April to wet our beaks after kind of a lackluster season. So basically what I tried to do is, like, you know, the big question that we have to ask ourselves is, was it as bad as we all thought it was? He was a bit of a, an easy target for us, for podcasters and media people, you know, media insiders like us. So I tried to go through and as much as I could, do some, like, statistical gerrymandering to, like, you know, put him in the best light. And it's not that easy. It's honestly not that easy.
That's so sweet of you to try to yeah. Our pod, to, like, try to figure out the positive in this.
Yeah, and I went, I was like, what's our record when Alan Crabb scores 20 points or more, and it's 7-7, it's 500, so.
it's better than the regular record, I guess.
Better, it's, you know, we are a 28-win team, so it says something.
Do you want the negative spin of that stat? Is essentially that, like, he doesn't show up most games, because that means he only had 14 games of 20 points.
Right.
If they got anything from him all season, they could have been a 500 team, but they didn't get anything from him for most of the season.
So the issue is, like, you know, obviously it's consistency, and it's not just about, like, it's not, you know, it's Danny Green level icy hotness, you know, it's like really, really bad games mar his statistics, in a pretty heavy way, like nights where he'll shoot 1 for 11, you know, like really, like poor shooting nights. So, like, that's, you know, if you're going to have half of your games be like really horrific shooting nights, I don't know how to fix that. That's a behavior, that's a habit that, like, just needs to change. Like, you can have bad games, but you can't have, you know, half of your games be these, like, 4.2 for 8 nights.
When you play fantasy football, if you sort of have, like, guys you rely on, you have your D'Angelo Russells, right? Whoever that would be, Le'Veon Bell or whoever. Alan Crabb's that wide receiver who gets you 21 points in a week, and then will get 2, 1, and 3, and tanks those weeks. Yeah, you win, like, so as you said, they're 500 when he scores more than 20 points. Well, when he doesn't score 20 points, I mean, how many wins did the Nets have this year? 24, something like that.
Wins?
Yeah.
28.
So that means that, like, without him, they only won 21 games when he didn't score 20 points. I mean, that's, like, not that much of a difference, but he was an impact in 7 games, and then the other ones, not that much of an impact.
There's interesting things, too. Like, so I was going in looking at his shot chart, and there seems to be, like, things that I might chalk up to, like, I hate to say this, but, like, missed opportunities, potentially bad coaching.
How dare you, Brian?
He's got, like, really, really, like, glaring hot spots in his shot chart. Like, weak side corner threes, shooting at 51%, only took 30 of them in the season. So, like, small sample size theater, but, like, why is Alan Crabb only taking 30 or 29 corner threes? And on the opposite side, on the strong side, he's shooting 33% and only shot 40. He's a really good finisher at the hoop, right? But he's only shot 76 from 0 feet, 76 attempts.
Which is less than, he played, I think, like 79 games or something, but that's less than one a game, which is
right.
not great.
So, yeah. Like, he's a really good finisher, and, like, they started to, so I was watching some of these, like, highlight reel things, you know, Free Dawkins, shout out your boy. And towards the end of the season, when he's getting these, like, that last, you know, that April run, there's a ton of, like alley-ooping layups, basically, to Alan Crabb, to, like, sort of, he does, like, when a defender starts to, like, he sinks, like, 5 threes in a row, and a defender starts to get up in his jersey a little bit, and he was pretty good at, like, shaking him and doing a backdoor cut and getting one of these, like, weird looping alley-oop layups from D'Angelo Russell or something. It seems like they made up a ton of lost ground in, like, the last month for those two pointers right at the rim for him. And maybe that's, like, how I'll paint this, like, look out for this next season. Like,
that's so sweet.
That's my positive spin.
So Alan Crabb's going to not be at the 3-point line. He's going to be cutting to the hoop.
The only thing is, like, you have to make those first five threes in order for anyone to want to be that up in your jersey so they can cut back door in the first place. So it's a little bit of a catch 22 there. I don't know. It's an interesting shot chart because, like, you know, he shot 400 times from the top of the key at a 37% rate.
Right.
And way more than anywhere else on the floor, like a ton of shots there at a, you know, above league average, you know, which is, but only by 2%. So,
and they're not so, okay. So I was trying to figure out the difference between his last year in Portland and his first year in Brooklyn. It's not like he was like amazing. There's a reason why the Trailblazers wanted to get rid of him beyond his salary, right? Like, cause like he ultimately wasn't that impactful for their team. This is a team that had playoff aspirations. They wanted to be pretty good, and they're not just. And Paul Allen owns them. Paul Allen, Microsoft. He has a ton of money. He famously spends a lot of money on both the Seattle Seahawks and the Portland Trailblazers. So, like, money wasn't the biggest of concerns. They got rid of him because of money and ineffectualness. But I did want to see. You know, he was 45% from three last season in Portland, 38% last year in Brooklyn. So, like, where's the difference? My first theory was openness. Okay, I figured playing with Lillard and McCollum, he was going to be open a lot more in Portland than playing with, you know, Spencer Dinwiddie and Caris LeVert. But it looks great. It's like NBA.com. Everyone's been there. They do incredible stats in terms of how open a guy is when they shoot and their three-point percentage and all that. He was open just as much. 60% of his shots last year were taken when he was classified as very open to open. Same thing as it was his last season in Brooklyn. Exact same amount of openness. I mean, last season in Portland. Same amount of openness, okay? The difference is he shot 45% from three when he was open to very open in Portland versus 39% in Brooklyn, okay? So it wasn't like he was getting fewer open shots. He was shooting the same amount of shots, being as open as he was in Portland, and he was not as good. The big difference is, so his catch and shoot threes were also down. 41% catch and shoot threes, 46% in Portland. Pull-up shots were the worst, okay? He took about two pull-up shots a game in Portland for 46%. He took three pull-up shots a game for 32% pull-ups. Anywhere on the floor, considering it's a pull-up, okay? Now, we mostly saw him do catch and shoots, but I'm saying, he was worse as a three-point shooter while being open. He was much worse as a shooter overall on pull-up shots. And he was worse as a catch-and-shoot shooter in Brooklyn than he was in Portland. He was worse across the board, and it had nothing to do with how defenses were keying him. He was as open as he ever was in Portland playing with Lillard and McCollum. How do you fix that? You just have to shoot better, right? I mean, because you can't get him more open looks than he was already getting in Portland. He is terribly important to this team because while we like to think that they have a lot of cap space, they don't. He is consuming a lot of it. Another guy that we're going to be talking about, Timofey Mozgov, is consuming as much of that cap space. It's just looking at his stats, it makes me feel even worse about his season because I had been operating, Brian, I was under the notion that he was getting worse shots in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
But you brought up that stat. I mean, I keep referencing it about the fact that the Nets take the best shots, right, in the league. The shots that produce the most likely outcome for success of any team. Or is Houston number one?
I'm going to try to remember what that stat was. No, it was the Nets. It was like qualified true shooting or something like that.
So that means, it should mean, everyone in the offense gets the best type of shots. When we watch Allen Crabbe play, they do try to get him, you know, the Korver type shot, you know, like the spinning off of a screen, catch and shoot. Most of his shots come with zero dribbles. Again, catch and shoot. And he's not good, or he wasn't good at it last season. And if he stinks, he doesn't stink. Okay, 38% from three is better than the league average, but at $19 million a year, you should be getting more than that. I was gonna try to figure out a stat, but I couldn't do it, and I want to do this later. Least valuable shooter, LVS. You take of all the guys who their main thing is 3-point shooting. So you would do something like 5 3-point field goal attempts a game. you take their salary and you divide that salary by their 3-point percentage.
Wow.
And, you know, like the $1 million, it'd be at the... So
you're just really gunning for Alan Crabb with this debt here.
And who do you think would be the least valuable shooter in the NBA?
I don't know, like Chandler Parsons? I don't know.
Chandler Parsons probably would be. Yeah. But you have to shoot like a certain number of threes. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You would have to be classified as a three-point shooter. Probably Russell Westbrook would be the worst, least valuable shooter because he shoots 32% and he takes an insane amount of threes. But I think Alan Crabb would be number two, least valuable shooter.
You know what's interesting in this? So, well, two things. First, so I went back and looked at his shot chart from last year, and like the beat on him to shoot from the top of the key, so it makes sense now because like he shot 45% from the top of the key last year. So like if you're in a, you know, coaching Alan Crabb, you think, okay, like that's a transferable skill, but for whatever reason, didn't happen. So anyways, just wanted to like amend a little bit on that. But en route to doing some of this research, I was looking at like comparisons for late blooming offensive players. Cause like, you don't see a ton of, you know, you can get like Ben Wallace and like, you know, Dennis Rodman who are like late bloomers because like they just, you know, become they like lockdown defenders or whatever, like late in their career. But it's not often that you see dudes at 26 or 27, just like turn on the elite scoring, you know, button in their life.
Right.
So I was like trying to find players like that. So I was looking at John Starks, who's like kind of one of those, but not really, obviously a very different player. But what was interesting was that John Starks in 1995 took 8 threes a game. He was attempting, which is a ton for that era.
Like complete outlier.
Yeah. In the same season, Reggie Miller attempted like 5, who's like, you know, known for shooting threes. So, and the most he ever took was 6 in a season. So yeah, I just thought that was interesting. Like he's, you know, ahead of the curve with the future of basketball, John Starks was.
And now, so like what happens with Alan Crabb? Like, I think, I don't know if we had this discussion on the pod last week, but just removing salary, even though it's impossible to do, Joe Harris versus Alan Crabb. I'd rather have Joe Harris out on the floor than Alan Crabb. Dude, it's so...
I like that you think that this question is such a, like... You're not removing the salary. You're just not.
Yes, Okay, here's my defense of Joe Harris over Alan Crabb. Joe Harris is a way better two-point shooter than Alan Crabb. He's just as good of a three-point shooter, and he has more capability to operate within the overall framework of the offense, where Alan Crabb has always been... Again, Kyle Korver type, which is someone who's running off his screens. He's waiting for the open shot where Joe Harris can get the ball at the three-point line. If someone comes at him right away, he can get around him and make a play and do something with it where Alan Crabb, it doesn't happen yet. Now, obviously, like, you know, we talk about, you know, defensive player of the year, Alan Crabb. Sure, way more talent defensively and can do way more things. But
yeah,
I'd rather have Joe Harris on the floor.
Super compelling, actually. So now I pulled up Joe Harris's shot chart, and he's shooting a you know, way above league average, 46.5% from the top of the key, which is where the Nets shoot a ton of shots because they run this like motion strong offense where they launch a three in the first 7 seconds of the clock from the top of the key. So his like that average right there is basically what you can attribute to like him sort of usurping Alan Crabb to a certain extent
because he hits those shots
and that's what we run that, like he took 248 of them, you know. Alan Crabb took 400 of them. That's a hugely popular shot on this team, and he's the one that was making them, you know.
So what I do think is, like, so we talked about Alan Crabb before the season started, and the whole idea was you expected the same type of player that you get in Portland, but you hoped to get someone who would be better. Is that question dead? Is it dead that the fact that, like, is Alan Crabb ever going to be really more than, like, he could be an elite three-point shooter. I'm going to give him that. I'm going to say that's his possibility. But can he be more than just a three-point shooter?
Like, maybe, and I'm not even sure if you want him to be necessarily, but... I mean, there is hope. There's obviously hope for, like, Alan Crabb. He's got a ton of skills that are, you know, that should be translatable. It's really, it's a matter of consistency, like I was saying. Like, it's, like, I mean, I'm going through and I'm trying to, again, build a generous case for that. Like, that consistency is going to change, and I really don't know if that's the case. I really don't know. It's sort of all over the place. The thing that is sort of startling, I would like it if he just got the same amount of shot attempts on a nightly basis. You know, that would be a good indicator for consistency. Like, just get those 10 shots up every night, like, no matter what. Doesn't matter if they're going in. Like, this night here, I'm just looking at, like, 1-for-4 against Philly in a bad loss. Okay, why? Why is Allen, like, what is going on here where the game plan has deviated so far away that Allen Crabbe's not getting any shots up that night?
Well, and that's sort of the frustrating thing about, because he's so reliant on the three-point shot, or at least that's the offense that the Nets are running to rely on him for that three-point shot, is that they can decide, regardless of what Allen Crabbe wants to do, they can decide to go away from trying to get Allen Crabbe the three and trying to do something else, whatever it is. Get, you know, pick and roll action with D'Angelo and Jared Allen, whatever it would be. I don't think Allen Crabbe, you know, it's obviously everyone can grow. Kenny Atkinson has done a lot for a lot of different players in terms of growing their games in ways we didn't expect. Ultimately, don't think Allen Crabbe's ever going to be anything more than, like, possibly an elite shooter. But if he's not even an elite shooter, which he was not this season, then he's not worth, obviously, $19 million. But he's not even really worth, like, 30 minutes a game. He's worth being on the floor, obviously. He's worth, you know, some playing half the game, which would be 24 minutes a game. But he's like, if we're going to do, like, who's the most interesting player to go into next season, besides the draft picks, which we don't even know what's going to happen with that, like D'Angelo, Jeremy Lin, like not Jared Allen, but who's coming up next, Allen Crabbe is super high up there because he really matters for the future of this team. He really needs to be an elite three-point shooter to fit into the offense, to make, because if he's an elite three-point shooter, that does change the complexion of the offense. Joe Harris is really good, but Joe Harris also is not quite elite. If Allen Crabbe can be elite, then you're really, like, that's an extra 6 points a game. Those extra 6 points a game is the difference between losing, you know, 12 games, right? The Nets lost so many close games past season. They had so many games that were screwed up because the last 2 minutes of refereeing, Brian, the referees screwed the Nets. If they had a guy who maybe hit two more threes a game than he did last season, that's, those 6 points is just a huge difference between a 28-win season to a 34, 36, and then add Jeremy Lin in the mix, add some draft picks, maybe a free agent, D'Angelo Russell full season. That's all those little incremental improvements add up to a big win improvement. But Allen Crabbe matters in that equation.
Mm.
You know who also matters, Brian?
Who's that?
Jared Allen. Brian,
wow, wowie woo-wa.
Our second guy in the troika of player reviews, Jared Allen, surprise draft pick. I mean, if we're going to go back all the way back, Brian, we did a draft night podcast where we're sitting there, we're expecting it to be, you know, a certain group of players who I don't even remember. I mean, Semi Ojeleye was a guy I was pushing for. Didn't happen. I still like Semi, of course. Jared Allen fell to the Nets. They picked him up, and everyone was shocked. One, that he was there, and two, that the Nets had picked him. He is arguably, I mean, I'm going through my Rolodex right here. Sean Marks' best move as a GM, possibly. Mm-hmm. You know, we're stands for the D'Angelo trade, but Jared Allen is a super late first round pick, 21st overall, I think, and he ends up being a guy who, like, is a real foundational piece for the future.
Yeah,
Brian.
I remember we were talking after that. Like, at some point in that podcast, you're like, "At what point does he start? Does he ever start on this team this season or whatever?" And somebody on Reddit, like the Go Nets Reddit thing, they took a massive dump on us for even suggesting that he was going to start. They were like, "He's going to the D League. He's a project." So
yes,
suck on that. Suck on that, boys.
I was so worried that he was going to be D leagued. That or G League, whatever, you know, like that he was going to be shoved down there and we're not going to see him play basketball. My biggest fears were, one, they're going to pick a guy like that, or two, they're going to pick a European that wouldn't be coming over to this team for three seasons. They got someone who mattered to the success of their team as a 19-year-old.
So did you see the reason why I chose these three players today is because it's a bit of a compliment sandwich, right? It's like we have it's Jared Allen's just a completely beautiful, like wonderful positive in a sea of, you know, somewhat controversial players who are like in a bit of flux. But Jared Allen's not like that. He's just a child. He's just a beautiful child, you know, and he's nothing but
positives, right?
There's nothing wrong with him. He can do no wrong. He's amazing. I love him right now.
I don't know if you saw, I tweeted out from our account, there's the shot where all the players are in LA and I guess they went on a hike or run through the mountains. Damari Carroll Instagrammed this, and there's Jared Allen slumped shoulders in the back, kind of like hiding, but like also smiling, looking like he's not like, not that he's not happy to be there, but just a shy guy, just an innocent young man. Doesn't really work.
19 years old, 19. Imagine you at 19 years old, Mike. That's how you are at 30 in a crowd.
So the pressing question for Jared Allen, Brian, is how good can Jared Allen be?
So I've been trying to like poke holes in the Jared Allen is like Clint Capela meme. And it's just not worth it because he really does play a lot like Clint Capela. It's very, a very accurate comparison. But here's the thing. Clint Capela is like 23 right now, and he's only putting up like, you know, the numbers that he's putting up, 14 points or something. And Jared Allen's way on his way to like, you know, eclipse that. So it's like, you know, Clint Capela plus a little bit more, right? That's, that's what we're going for.
Well, and so I was like, I just like clicked NBA stats, centers, points per game, just to sort of tear it up for me of who Jared Allen can be. Can we say he's not going to be like Karl Anthony Towns or Embiid, Marcus Gasol? Like, he's not going to be a primary option big.
No, and that's not, maybe we'll eventually acquire the skills to do that kind of thing, but that's not a pressing concern. It's not a priority.
And I would say he's already better than the Gortat, John Henson, Dwayne Dedmon, anyone like so. And even if you look at like the rosters of who the teams are in the finals right now, like obviously he's not Kevin Love, Tristan Thompson type, but like as a center, Jared Allen has a chance to be more impactful as an actual center because Kevin Love is not a center, even though he has to play center, and Tristan Thompson is a center, but he's like not good. Jared Allen's better than anyone the Warriors have, besides if you consider Draymond Green a center. And then you look at the Rockets and our buddy Clint Capela. You know, so like ultimately, the goal for Jared Allen has to be he's already above the crappy starting center, right? He's already above that level. Defensively, the way he impacts the game, already above it. He probably will never be primary option scoring center. Those skills already would be evident even though he's so young. What he is Clint Capela, 85% of Dikembe Mutombo, maybe. I mean, I just say that because Mutombo was pretty amazing defensively. He could be a smaller, quicker Gobert. You know, give me a little bit of that, even though Gobert's whole point is that he's super tall. There's nothing but good things, Brian, about Jared Allen. It goes beyond the fact that like he could catch some balls and dunk them. You know, he showed a patience as a player that at 19 years old that you don't normally see. You don't like normally see a guy at that age at that position, center, to like be able to catch a ball and actually hold on to it for 2 seconds and then make a move. Like most of the time, guys are freaking out. They just want to dunk the ball or they want to get it up to the rim so they can get rid of it. Where he like actually has the part of his brain that says, I'm going to slow down for a second, see what happens to the defender, and then I'm going to make the move that I need to make. Super
fantastic. He really put it together very quickly. And I'm just looking again at the Clint Capela stats. At age 21, those stats were very similar, with the exception of the free throw percentage. Can't say enough good about the fact that Jared Allen shoots 77% from the three-point line. Like, of all the things that make him a dynamic, you know, potential player going forward, that for me is like the most glaring. Like, okay, he has the potential to be actually like very special, because it just puts you in a totally different. Sorry, were you talking about? I think my connection's messed up.
No, I'm with you.
Anyways, I think that's just like such a unique skill for a player at that position that has like those you know, what you would think is like traditional center, like sucks at free throw shooting skills. So yeah, puts him in a different category potentially.
I mean, so like there are three things that take centers off the floor right now in the NBA. It's athleticism, the fact that they can't hang with, you know, smaller guards. I mean, I think it's sort of like when a fallacy, Brian, the fact that centers are, like we say, like this center can guard 1 through 5, like Mo Bamba. Mo Bamba's in the draft this year, super long and super athletic. People are like, he can even guard point guards. That never happens. Just doesn't happen. Centers can never actually guard point guards. Not even Joel Embiid can really guard a point guard. He can stay with him on his hip, but he never actually guards him. So athleticism knocks you off the floor as a center, and he has athleticism. Free throw shooting knocks you off the floor as a center. If you can't hit your free throws at the end of the game, you don't play at the end of the game. And the third thing is three-point shooting. Now
foul trouble, too.
Well, foul trouble. And I don't know. I don't remember Jared Allen's foul stats. I
don't have any stats for it, but it doesn't seem like it was an issue. I don't recall it being an issue.
Not like, you know, like actually like Joel Embiid, another guy who at least initially had incredible amount of fouls. I remember in the summer league games he would play, he would get the 8 fouls that you actually could get in summer league. And then 3-point shooting. You know, guys are now taken off the floor because you want 4 3-point shooters around a ball handler. I still don't care about that for my center. I still would rather have a big guy who can dunk the ball, can get offensive rebounds, can extend possessions, can stop the other team's possessions by a block or a rebound. I still think that's more valuable than having the 4th 3-point shooter on the floor around a ball handler. But like, so again, all the things that you would take him off the floor for in the modern NBA, he has athleticism to stay on the floor and he has a free throw shooting to stay on the floor. So there's no reason why he cannot be a component in this team's success in the future when they're actually trying to win games. As good as DeAndre Jordan is, he cannot do things, certain things, that make him not worth the max contract. I'm not saying Jared Allen's a max contract guy, but, you know, it's like there's not going to be an argument against having Jared Allen. There's not. The only thing would be 3-point shooting, and I don't want that. I really don't want him to start shooting threes. That's not my style of ball.
Mm. No, it feels nice that we have like at least one position solidified. Like, hey, we have a really great, you know, prospect at a pivotal position going forward. We have it locked in. It's part of the system. It works perfectly. Like, check that off the list, Mike.
You know who's also locked in going forward, Brian?
Who's that?
Timofey Mozgov.
Oh boy. I don't have anything to say about it. This is like, I want you to, so here's actually funny. On our last episode, you got a hater coming after you, Mike.
Please.
And are you ready to hear it? So this is also like why, anyways, it's funny. So first of all, his name is Gene Parmesan, which may surpass Joey Bag of Donuts for my favorite, like New York City, euphemism name guy. Anyways. Get this. Ready? Here's the subject line. Brian needs to take the reins. Dudes, a little feedback. Mike seems to talk for about 80% of the show, and he's become an absolute hot take machine. Anyways, it goes on. But he's like, Mike's taking too many hot takes. So here's the thing. I can't do what Mike does. Mike is a professional. Mike's in the biz.
Yeah,
and he's in the business of hot takes, and he can carry a conversation where I cannot. So... And here's a perfect example of this because I don't have anything to say about Timofey Mozgov, and I know Mike has a ton to say about Timofey Mozgov. That's the difference between us, Gene Parmesan. So I take it, you know, hey, you're my boy. We can be boys forever. But Mike is a special talent. We got to give him the ball. He's the James Harden of this podcast. Okay? I'm just the Chris Paul.
Well, so if I'm going to talk about Timofey Mozgov, do you think I'm going to talk about his on-the-court production or can he be traded, Brian? What do you imagine I'm going to want to talk about?
I think I know.
Okay. So the big question with him, he's never going to play really ever for the Nets, I think. I actually kind of argued for him to play last year because there was that moment when the Nets were actually they were losing games because they didn't have a backup center. And I don't really understand why he can't be a backup center. Like, as bad as he may be, I don't think he's that bad where he can't get 10 minutes a game. It's just that Atkinson doesn't want to play him. right?
He's,
I mean,
I think he's like emotionally checked out. I think he's like, my professional career is it's and it's a death rattle right now. Like, I just don't care that much. Like, you can, he definitely has the skills to do it, but like, he does not have the willpower.
It's an insane thing about being like a professional athlete, because like, you used to work in the literary world, right?
Once upon a time,
you could be a crappy author and your name could be John Grisham, and you could put out a book. You could basically ride the bench, but put out a book under your name, and it makes a whole bunch of money, right?
Yeah.
But like, we don't criticize John Grisham necessarily because his books aren't good, but we criticize Timofey Mozgov because he's making a ton of money and he can't play basketball anymore. Like, he knows, Timofey Mozgov knows, that everyone knows how much money he's making and how bad he may be at basketball. The fact that he can't play basketball anymore, which I don't agree with. Again, I think
that's an interesting comparison to draw.
Well, I'm just trying to think of, like, pretty much in every other profession, you could be bad at your job, but we don't criticize your salary. You know, I don't know if you saw this, but like, you know who Katie Nolan is for ESPN?
No.
So she was just hired from Fox. She did a show on Fox Sports that was like, she basically was like operating out of a closet, but she's like very good on Instagram, social media. She's funny. So she's like that class of personality, and she got hired at ESPN for making, and now she's making allegedly more than $1 million a year. And she doesn't do all that much. And the New York Post was writing about how, like, how is she worth $1 million? And that's like a really weird thing. For a fact, like, a media member is criticizing another media member for how much they're making, because how much that person, Katie Nolan, is making is elevating the salaries of everyone else. That's sort of, if people are getting paid more for the job that you're doing, then you may actually get also paid more. But like, in basketball, in sports, we know how much these guys are making. We know it. Like, and they know that we know it, and that we, like with Alan Crabb, we attach salaries to their, you know, to how we view them.
Yeah.
And he knows that, like, he's not worth,
I mean,
16 years.
For me, I've always suspected that, like, anytime, you know, there's like a kind of a meme where a college basketball fan will be like, I don't like the NBA because they're paid too much. That's always a bit of a low-key racist thing to say, in my opinion.
Yes.
I think I get what you're getting at there. And it's always kind of like bandied about, and a bit of a, like, to be keyed in on who this Caitlin Nolan, who would you say?
Katie Nolan.
Whatever her name is. Yeah. Seems like, you know, a bit of an opportunity for people to, anyways, to jump on a situation like that. I never do it, because it's not my money, and I want everyone to make it rain.
To make $16 million a year.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not my money. What am I? You know, let's have a party. Come on.
All right. So here's what we're gonna get. I try to go through. So obviously, like, there's like two things you can do with Mozgov. Well, there are three things you can do. One would be to actually play him and try to get value out of that $16 million a year. He's got $16 million this upcoming season, then $16.7 million the season after that. They're not going to play him because they don't want to play. They don't want to have two centers. They really only want Jared Allen, and then they want Quincy AC types to play the five. So they're not going to play him. The other option is to do the stretching provision. I'm anti-stretch provision. I think it's bad. I'd rather take my medicine now. Just I don't want to do the next 6 years of $7 million to Timofey Mozgov. I'd rather do 2 years of 16 each, you know, something like that. Because the Nets are still paying Darren Williams, and it's just $5 million, but that's $5 million that if they had that $5 million, they could then sign a guy for $22 million this offseason or whatever. You know, that's money that they could be playing with. Okay, so then it's trade possibilities. The only way you can trade Timofey Mozgov is if you take a worse contract back, pretty much. That's the only way it really makes sense. He has no value this season. He does have value next season because he is an expiring contract next season. The two names that I will give you that I think are very possible for the Nets to get using Timofey Mozgov are Ryan Anderson, Nick Batum.
Wow.
Nick Batum.
Nick
Batum makes a heck of a lot of money. I think he makes like 25 a year for the next three seasons. He makes $27 million his last season, a player option, which I'm sure he will opt into. Okay, Ryan Anderson makes more money than Timofey Mozgov, and he doesn't play basketball anymore. He's on the bench. So is it worth getting rid of Mozgov to take a guy who may actually be useful for you? If that means, so what in those scenarios, both of those guys are making an extra year on their contract. I'd rather just stick with Mozgov, stick him on my bench, and live with having him on my team for 2 years than having Ryan Anderson for three. Even though in those three seasons he could be helpful.
Ryan Anderson definitely not. Ryan Anderson, like, I mean, bless his heart. I mean, the Batum thing is kind of interesting because at least, like, in terms of how people talk about the Charlotte Hornets, people are getting anxious for them to do a rebuild, it seems like, or, like, something needs to change. That's often the conversation around them. So there might be some outside pressure to, like, mix things up. So it seems like that could be a possibility, maybe.
Well, and it's a big difference. I mean, I think it's so Mozgov's making about 16, 17. Batum's making about 25. So that difference is, even though they're both huge numbers, that difference is what, $8 million? That's a significant amount of money that'd be coming off the Hornets' books. Mm-hmm. And he's someone who would be good with the Nets. He fits sort of what this team would want to do. But then you're paying Nick Batum $25 million and Allen Crabbe $19 million. You can play them both on the floor, but those are similar positions. I mean, you know, they operate in the same sort of, you know, space a bit.
They presumably like Nick Batum enough, though, that they'd want something of value back, not just Timofey Mozgov.
Yeah, so it'd have to be, I mean, like, so, you know, we'll do the Rondé pod. Rondé is always interesting to see. I mean, I know he has a contract coming up soon. I don't know what he'll get paid. I don't know how many teams value Rondé, but he makes the most sense for a team that because the Nets, I would think in any scenario, the Nets are not going to part with like LeVert or D'Angelo or Jared Allen. I think those are the holy grail. Dinwiddie, it seems, has been floated out there and they asked a lot for him, but I think they're coming more to the realization that we should probably trade Dinwiddie. And Damari Carroll, who... You can't combine Damari Carroll and Mozgov because that amount of money is over $30 million, and no team's going to take on that much money unless they're giving away like Dwight Howard and Batum. Which is, would you want Dwight Howard and Batum?
Wow, that's an interesting question.
I mean, that we could make that happen, Brian. I could call Michael Jordan right now.
Do you actually think if you just straight up like getting rid of those expiring for those two dudes, like, does that actually make that happen?
I think. I need to look at,
because like on paper, like, could you imagine on paper, like, for a like casual fan to see that, they're gonna be like, this is the most lopsided trade of all time. Oh my god. And then I guarantee somebody's gonna tweet at us something to that effect, like, god, the Twitter people, the worst. Well, yeah,
you get out of, if you're the Hornets, this is from the I kind of love this trade now. From the Hornets perspective, I need to look at how many seasons Dwight Howard has coming up. But I think Dwight Howard still has two seasons left on his deal. You get two cheaper players in Mozgov and Damari Carroll. You get to send away the more expensive players' longer-term contracts. So you very quickly get out of cap hell, and it puts the Nets probably back into cap hell. I doubt that this is what the Nets would do, but
This is just hypothetically, people. Hypothetically. Everyone calm down.
The same GM who traded for Allen Crabbe at a huge number and also gave Otto Porter a max contract is also the same GM that probably would not poo-poo a Batum trade.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And if Dwight Howard was part of that Batum trade, that they could get rid of, they get rid of a center who they're never going to play for a center who actually would be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
If you're splitting your center minutes between Jared Allen and Dwight Howard, not bad. I'm not saying it's out of the question. I'm just saying I wouldn't think it would happen, but that's the type of trade you have to think of. You have to start taking some really crappy contracts back to get rid of Mozgov. I don't think there's a motivation to do it though. They want to just let him sit on the bench.
It would be a hilarious pivot to go from where we are now, like, this, don't skip any steps. We're doing the rebuild the right way, to we have Dwight Howard now.
And like everyone would blame Joseph Tsai for coming in and like,
yeah,
like he immediately wants to win. I'm looking up Dwight Howard's contract, by the way, right now, Brian. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. He has 2 years left at $23.5 and $23.8 million. So he's making significantly more than Mozgov.
Mm-hmm.
He only has one season left. Okay. He only has one season left at 23.8. So he's still making a lot of money, but he's an expiring free agent too. So that actually incentivizes me as a Nets person to do that trade even more, because then I just get out of the Dwight Howard deal and I get out of, and I'm happy. I'm just a happy guy. I'm done. I haven't.
Yeah. I mean, the Hornets probably don't need that much short notice, or like, what are they going to do with all that cap space in the short term?
Just get out of much. Like, just so Michael Jordan doesn't have to pay these people a lot of money. That's all. I mean, he doesn't want to do that. I mean, he has been doing it. They've insane contracts on their books.
Are you excited for the Netflix documentary about Michael Jordan?
Dude, I'm peaked. My interest is peaked.
Well, if he's involved in it, you know that it's going to be a complete. What is it? He's just going to chop it up so that he makes himself look really good. That's what he does with everything that he's involved in.
Well, I heard. Not heard. I mean, Bill Simmons talked about it on his podcast, is that when they were originally doing the 30 for 30 series, they had this footage. This footage has been around forever, and they were like very close to getting this documentary done, but Jordan didn't want it to happen because he looked like a dick in it. He looked like a jackass. I'll defend that jackass. Go for it, Michael. You're Michael Jordan.
I think he's doing a really bad job of like the PR that's out there, that like you're a jerk is not being helped by you like crushing any media position that says like, well, you know, Michael Jordan's a competitive jerk at times, and then like you swoop in and like sue everybody. Like, that doesn't help your case. Like, that's, yeah.
So my question is, like, now that he's agreed to be a part of the documentary, does that mean that the footage that they have, they're going to withhold some of the best stuff that makes him not look great, but is the truth of the situation? Or has he come around to the fact that, like, maybe I need to be honest here? I'm hearing, you know, he's a competitive guy and he's hearing LeBron is the greatest player of all time.
Yeah.
Gorn versus GOAT. He's becoming the GOAT.
Dude, Michael Jordan is the most litigious dude on the planet. He is insane with keeping the Jordan brand like squeaky clean. He will definitely like put his mark on that whatever it is, like whether stuff gets edited out or not, like, but, like, he's, there was a thing in, do you remember this, like some grocery store, some like local grocery store in Chicago, like put up a there was like a sale and they used his likeness in the window or something, and he sued that, like, you know, family run grocery store, and the lawsuit was, you know, it took like 10 years, family like went out of business, whatever, and Michael Jordan showed up in court for like the hearing or whatever, and the judge, like, there's like a, you know, document of this transcription, and he's like, you know, Michael, I understand like why Gatorade's lawyers are here and why Nike's lawyers are here, but why are you here? Why are you here? What is what's happening here? Like, why are you doing this with your time? And I just thought that was like kind of a perfect encapsulation of like, he will go fly out to Chicago to like go watch a family get like totally crushed by his lawyers
because, you know, he's got to win.
Yes, he's got to win. Yeah.
But so that then, okay. So I could argue both ways, right? I could say, well, he likes to protect his image. He's been super protective of his image. He's a pretty private person, even though he was the biggest star in the world at one point. So he's going to try to continue to protect his image. Or I could argue, which is what I actually believe, is that he sits back in his chair. He owns an NBA team, but he sits back and hears all this praise for LeBron and sees people comparing LeBron to his legacy and people now saying LeBron is better. And he's thinking, maybe I should remind everyone exactly who I was and who I am, because there's our generation and the generation below us that don't really remember Jordan. I mean, I remember Jordan. I'm sure most people our age remember Jordan, but like, we weren't like super plugged in about Jordan, right? I mean, we were pretty young.
I mean, I was right there, 10 years old when he was winning his championships. Like, that's kind of prime.
That's prime.
Idolizing. We love Michael Jordan
him,
age.
But like, we can't.
I actually don't. It was a little bit too much of a meme at that point for me to like go. I mean, you don't want to be the guy that loves Michael Jordan and you're from like New Jersey or whatever. That just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. It wasn't a problem in DC because we had the Wizards and they're horrible. Yeah. But but we can't accurately defend his legacy. We're too young. We didn't have the catalog of memory to like really. I don't feel like I could accurately defend Allen Iverson's legacy. But Jordan was just a little too, I was a little too young to really like give you the, because I'll defend Allen Iverson completely. Like, because I know people are going to be coming at that throne for years because his stats are horrible. But I'm going to defend Allen Iverson. But
defend him how? Like, what are you defending him against?
Against the stats revolution and people saying that he was actually like a detrimental to his team, the way he played basketball. And I was like, I saw Eric Snow and Aaron McKee and Todd McCullough and old Dikembe. I knew what his team was like, and he was playing the way he had to play. Anyways, if I am Michael Jordan now and I want to defend my legacy, the best thing I can do is put out an awesome documentary that is super honest, that lays it all out there, that reminds people I am a psychopath and I will do anything to win. And if that means I have to make Scottie Pippen cry in the locker room every night, if that means that I can take him, that's how I can win, that's what I would do. That's how I would defend it. So I would hope the documentary opens
it up. So here's the issue. It's like, I think he's okay with that to a certain extent, but when other people, back to my old days in publishing, we had a deal to do a book about the oral history of Michael Jordan, and his lawyers shut that down because he doesn't like it when other people have things to say about Michael Jordan. So if he can control the narrative, I could see like a version of it where he's like, I was competitive. But when somebody else is like, no, he punched Steve Kerr in the face. He was an asshole. that he's probably not going to love.
You know, and I will say, so like my whole defense of Jordan being a better player than LeBron comes down to the fact that like LeBron has done this 1-year contract stuff and he's held his team hostage for years. And that's actually hurt his team. The people around him on the team, I mean the other players on the team, that has hurt who is around him because he can't give any team a guarantee that he's going to be on the team for a long time. To knock LeBron is the way he treats other teammates and he treats others in the organization. But Jordan was probably worse, right? Jordan was like way more a negative force on a team in terms of their overall, you know, like vibe than LeBron has ever been. I don't know. I'm super excited for the doc. I hope it's...
What do you want, Mike? You want a good vibe or you want chips? Okay? One or the other. Take them or leave them.
Good vibes, then. Give me Shaq's career anytime. Yeah. Just good vibes.
Like, Mike, you have a ton of good vibes and no chips, and I don't think anyone blames you for that decision.
We'll be back with you, next week sometime? We'll figure it out. A little news. My wife is about to give birth.
Whoa.
So she's like about to give birth. So I don't know exactly how that's going to play with our pods. I made sure that the due date is way before the draft so we could properly analyze the draft.
Pod comes first. Forget that baby.
So if the baby comes next week, which it may, probably not next week, but we'll see. We'll try to pump out these pods so that when the baby comes, maybe we'll take a little break. Unless if you want to come over here, Brian, with the screaming baby and do baby pod.
I'll do whatever, man. I don't care.
All right. We'll be back with you next week. Next week, we'll do Caris LeVert and two other guys. We'll start with Caris LeVert, and then we'll figure out the other two later this week.
Great tease. Hey, check us out. NetsDaily.com, AlmightyBaller.com, iTunes ratings. Mike, what kind of score are we looking for exactly?
I think we're looking for 5 stars. If we can get we love
5 stars. And if you give it up, we'll shout you out. I think we should start shouting people out who do that. That's what other podcasts do. And that's, you know, we got to incentivize the people out there, Mike. Anyways, thanks everybody. Talk to you soon. Bye bye now. Yeah, boy.